So why Lent? Why Lent? Especially now. Especially coming to the end of a term, during an otherwise sad month, with little daylight and very little in the way of anything to look forward to. Why would the church pile on? Why would the church focus its attention on a penitential season? One that is peculiarly intense, which sometimes seems impossibly difficult, especially when we're overeager at the outset. So Lent, with its insistence on prayer and fasting and almsgiving, puts before our eyes, it kind of places before us in a way that we cannot dismiss, our own limitedness, our own weakness, our own inability, which can oftentimes be a very terrible realization. So how could this be good? How could this possibly be something desirable? How could it possibly be something saving? Now, there's a notion abroad that progress is inevitable, that due to advances in technology or to increased learning in, you know, whatever particular subject matter or whatever particular discipline, that the state of humanity will just, as if by a law, ineluctably get more and more perfect, that man will inevitably progress into a place of greater and greater happiness and abundance. But this notion has been abroad for some time now, and it has pretty significant critics. I was just talking about J.R.R. Tolkien in a conversation last night, and Tolkien is quoted as having said, "Progress, I do not believe in progress." He said, "I'm a Christian, and in fact a Catholic, and so I believe that we are destined to suffer a long defeat, with momentary snatches of redemption, but nevertheless a long defeat." Now, I don't mean that to be kind of like dispiriting and depressing. It's to be understood in a certain way. But G.K. Chesterton was another one who actually engaged with this idea and inveighed against it. At the time during which he lived, one particular author, Wells, who was famous for his fiction, wrote a book called The Outline of History. This is H.G. Wells. He wrote The Outline of History. And the basic tenet was that things just get better because of technology, because of wider and more profound learning. Things just get better. And Chesterton looked around and said, that is decidedly not the case. Because he says there's no principle that we can depend on to work itself out inevitably. There's no intrinsic principle of evolution. Rather, he said, what I observe is a principle of devolution. He says, the only thing that we can rely upon to play itself out inevitably is original sin. At every turn, we witness it undermining the efforts of human beings, tinging the human spirit with selfishness and with weakness and ugliness and moral turpitude. G.K. Chesterton wrote this. He says, modern masters of science are much impressed with the need of beginning all inquiry with a fact. The ancient masters of religion were quite equally impressed with that necessity. They began with the fact of sin, a fact as practical as potatoes. Whether or no man could be washed in miraculous waters, there was no doubt, at any rate, that he wanted washing. But certain religious leaders in London, not mere materialists, have begun in our day not to deny the highly disputable water, but to deny the indisputable dirt. The idea being there that we have to come to grips with the fact that we are unable, on our own steam, to achieve our goals. And you have two options set before you. Either you admit the fact that you're broken, wounded, and limited, or you deny it outright altogether and redefine what progress and what perfection looks like. So, Chesterton encouraged, in every age, he says, we have to subject this notion to critique, and that the human spirit can only be vindicated by vigilance. We need to keep watch. We need to wait for the Lord. So I would put it to you, and this is the point of the talk, I would put it to you that true spiritual progress entails a rehearsal of redemption. True spiritual progress entails a rehearsal of redemption. And here I'm going to take another image from G.K. Chesterton. He writes this. This is the beginning of his book, Orthodoxy, which he wrote in 1908, just after having converted to Christianity, but some years before he converted to Catholicism. He says, I have often had a fancy for writing a romance about an English yachtsman who slightly miscalculated his course and discovered England under the impression that it was a new island in the South Sea. His mistake was really a most enviable mistake, and he knew it, if he was the man I take him for. What could be more delightful than to have in the same few minutes all the fascinating terrors of going abroad combined with all the humane security of coming home again. What could be better than to have all the fun of discovering South Africa without the disgusting necessity of landing there? What could be more glorious than to brace oneself up to discover New South Wales and then realize with a gush of happy tears that it was really Old South Wales? So I would put it to you that Lent is a story of loss and of recovery, but one that brings about a true progress, the kind of progress that Chesterton describes in rediscovering something from which we have departed. So we're going to walk it, we're going to kind of pursue it from the vantage of salvation history, with the notion that Jesus Christ, as the letter to the Hebrews says, is the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who, for love of us, despises the shame of the cross, but endures it. So, what remains is for us to walk the same path, and that Lent is an especially focused way to do that. So, we'll take three steps. First, innocence. Second, sin. And third, redemption. So first, innocence. We believe that we were created well. We were created good. Just take 1 second with that. We were created good. At each stage in the first creation story recounted in Genesis 1, we are told that it was good. At every day, there's a kind of created pause as God contemplates what he has wrought. And at the end of the sixth day, the day on which he creates the animals and man and woman, God pauses to say that it is very good, that we issue from the hand of God according to his intent, that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, which is an awesome fact, one with which we need contend. So we believe, or it's often professed in the Christian tradition, that we were created in grace. And sometimes it's referred to as a state of original justice or original innocence, and sometimes you hear it referred to by the name of rectitude. So just different variations on the same theme. Now, in that state, we can identify three distinct things, and we want to distinguish them so as to have a better appreciation of what's going on. So first, there is grace. Grace is simply a created share in God's divine life, okay? A created share in God's divine life. Second, we have what St. Thomas calls integral nature, which is to say that our loves, our desires, fired on all cylinders, and that we loved aright, according to right knowledge. And then third and finally, there are these privileges associated with the original state. You sometimes hear them referred to as preternatural gifts, which means like beyond nature. And these are the ones that kind of start sounding a little bit science fiction-y. But cool. So we would have been immortal, so we wouldn't have died. Also, we would have been impassible, so we would not have suffered decay or corruption or pain or sorrow or fear. There would have been no tears to wipe away. So let's kind of break out a small description of each of these three things. So we say that we are created in grace with a harmony obtaining. So grace is the most important thing here. The most distinctive thing about us as created individuals is that from our inception, we are oriented to supernatural life with God, right? So we don't issue from God's hand as something neutral. We don't issue from God's hand as something kind of ambivalent or lacking a trajectory. We are always and everywhere intended for communion, for supernatural life. I have one brother who says that we are accustomed to have a conversation with ourselves about ourselves, right? Like when you wake up early in the morning and you turn off your alarm on your phone and you begin almost instantaneously mulling over the many things that you have to do for the rest of the day, right? And it becomes for you a source of anxiety and like crippling fear and like budding depression. Right, he says like we were never intended for that. We were always intended to be kind of broken up, out, and open into conversation and communion with God. So grace ensures that. It makes it such that we are friends of the Most High God and adopted sons and daughters. So grace is what's most important. It's the formal element. And what it does is that it makes divine life almost natural to us. Now that's to speak improperly, but it's like we have a second nature, one that accords with our nature, one that brings it to perfection. It doesn't repress it, right? It doesn't run roughshod over it, but rather it brings what is best out. So like, for instance, like if you're thinking about what do I do with my life? What is my vocation? Well, it's a valid thing to consult your desire. It's a valid way to proceed to consult what it is that you love. Because grace does not scrap nature. Rather, it heals it, it purifies it, it emboldens it, it brings it to perfection. So the first question is not like, what should I do? Ah, crippling anxiety, right? The first question is, Am I receiving the sacraments in a worthy state? Do I have a life of prayer? Do I have, like, a bit of discipline, a bit of penance in my life? Do I have good friendships? And if the answer to those questions is yes, then the next question you can ask is, what do I want? Just what do I want? Because the Lord is moving and healing and leading, and that's awesome, and you can trust that. So it makes divine life almost connatural to us, in a sense. It orients us to our supernatural end. But we can also say that it ruins us for life, because we will always have been created in grace. We will have always been destined for life eternal, and you can't turn back the clock on that. So to step outside of the bounds of grace is not, again, it's not something you can do without offending God. And that's not to, like, assign blame, or that's not to kind of heap coals on an otherwise bad situation. But that is to say that we're made in relation, and that friendship marks us, and as a result of which it changes everything. So that's the first, grace. The second is what we call integral nature. So I said it's like we're firing on all cylinders. We're loving as we ought to. Okay? So nature received a perfection and a vigor that it would not have had if left to itself. So you can think about it. We as human beings are like one big open wound of desire. We want all kinds of things. In the most basic sense, we want preservation of existence. We want integrity of bodily life. So we want to eat. We want to drink, especially at the end of a long Ash Wednesday, right? We want to, you know, procreate, you know, have sexual intercourse for the procreation and education of children to build up our family life. It's like, not only do I want to preserve my own bodily integrity, but I want to ensure that this whole human experiment thing keeps going, right? So that's most basic. But also we have these desires, these loves, these aspirations that are common to all animals, right? So I want to move. I want to experience. I want to be kind of bound up in all of the loveliness of this world. I want to gaze on things beautiful. I want to almost ingest them, right? So we can't stay neutral to beautiful things because they allure us. They call out from us something that we didn't even know present before the vision, right? We want all that. But even more yet, we want to know and we want to love. Not just one thing or two things, but we want to know to an infinite extent because our minds are made as for what is universally true, or you could just say what is true with a capital T, and our hearts are made for what is universally good. Again, you could just say good with a capital G. As a result of which, we find that in trying to find our happiness in limited things, be it wealth or honor or fame or power or pleasure or whatever, that it never satisfies because they simply cannot bear the weight of our whole heart's love, right? So we have all of these desires, and as we have come to experience in our own lives, they are not necessarily coordinated, right? So I can want to pray a holy hour because I love the Lord and he's worth everything, but I can also want to eat many chocolate chip cookies, right? I look at a plate of chocolate chip cookies, and I don't want to eat 1.5, which would probably be like an ordinate caloric intake for that time of day. You know, it's like, I'm feeling about 285 calories worth of desire right now. No, I want to eat that whole plate of chocolate chip cookies twice, right? Once is not even enough, right? So, and all of a sudden, I eat 6, 7, 8, and then whatever happens in your body with respect to glucose and insulin, I don't know. I'm insensitive to the inner workings of my, you know, whatever life. But then I'm in front of the Blessed Sacrament and I'm like, I love you, Jesus. And I also love napping. And that's the end of it. It was a good 3 minutes, but the next 57 are spent with my, you know, my chin on my chest. So all of these desires, this big open wound of desire with all of its complex and multifarious dimensions is not necessarily coordinated. But in a state of integral nature, it would have been. It would have been. So the lower powers would have been subject to the higher powers. Our body would have been subject to our soul. And St. Thomas adds that all of material creation would have been subject to man. So carnivores would have still eaten their prey, but they would have posed no threat to us, because from us would have radiated a kind of peace and order and tranquility that would have affected even the animal kingdom. So first, we said, is grace, which is the biggest ticket item. Second is this thing of integral nature. And third and finally are these further privileges associated with original justice. We said this is immortality, and the big word for not being able to suffer pain or corruption is impassibility, from patience or patior, which just means to suffer. So we would have found it easy to pass through life. We would never have known the sorrow attendant upon tragedy. We would have never have known the anxiety born of bodily illness, we would have never have known the pain of loss. Okay? And St. Thomas kind of coordinates all this, and he says we can observe a fourfold subordination. All right? Subordination sounds like a bad word, right? Sometimes we encounter it in reading Ephesians 5, verses 21 and following about marriage. Be subordinate to each other out of reverence for Christ. Wives, be subordinate to your husbands. I live with a particular Dominican who calls this Nudge Sunday, right? Because men who don't otherwise listen to the proclamation of the epistle start going. So there's a fourfold subordination that obtains. So we said that all of material creation is subordinate to man, body to soul, lower powers to higher powers, but it all hinges on the highest, namely our minds would have been subordinated to God. Not in a way that treats us as so many slaves or servants, but in a way that was ennobling, because we could actually see the objective order of things and it resonated in our lives. So, God intended that this gift be conferred not only on our original parents, but on all of those who came from them. He intended that this be a permanent fixture in our lives. It's not just something fragile, which is destined to shatter. It hangs in the balance, and that original choice against him need not have been so. So this is God's intent for us. That's our first point, innocence. Second, let's continue down the path. Sin. Here we want to talk about the fall. Again, I'll quote G.K. Chesterton. I should say a word of introduction. I don't presume that people have heard of him. I'm a nerd who likes him a lot. But he was born in 1874, and he died in 1936. He lived in Beaconsfield, just outside of London. And he was principally an essayist and journalist, but he wrote quite a number of popular apologetics, so popular defenses of the faith, the most famous of which is called Orthodoxy. Another very famous one is called The Everlasting Man. If you've heard the name and you're slightly interested in reading him, I'd recommend starting with the Father Brown stories. The idea is that there is a priest who is also a detective, and the way that he solves crime is basically being sensitive to what is in the heart of man. And it's beautiful. He's asked in one of the stories, how is it that you solve all of these murders? And he says, somewhat ironically, because I've committed them all. Which is a profound notion about our complicity in sin. A profound notion about what it means, I suppose, you know, for him to be a priest, is to know all of sin and yet, in God's grace and please God, you know, to remain aloof from it. So, Chesterton writes this, all of virtue is in an if. The note of the fairy utterance always is, you may live in a palace of gold and sapphire if you do not say the word cow. Or you may live happily with the king's daughter if you do not show her an onion. The vision always hangs upon a veto. All the dizzy and colossal things conceded depend upon one small thing withheld. All the wild and whirling things that are let loose depend upon one thing that is forbidden. The point here isn't just to be strange or to be paradoxical, but he's highlighting the fact that original sin to us probably seems a bit arbitrary, right? You can live in eternal bliss provided that you don't touch fruit on this random tree that I planted in the middle of the garden. It seems almost as if God were tempting our first parents. It seems as if he was setting them up to fail. But Chesterton is highlighting the fact that the enjoyment of bliss always hangs upon a choice. It always hangs upon an act of obedience, not one of servile fear, but one of affection, one of devotion, one of friendship. Because we are not the standard of our flourishing. We cannot give adequate account for our lives. There will always be a higher standard, because we are created and God is not. And so to enjoy that bliss means always to receive it from him. So that's why the first act of sin, or the kind of primeval act of disobedience, is usually classed as a sin of pride. So it's sometimes thought, St. Thomas says, that either Adam and Eve, or our first parents, wanted God on their own terms. That is to say, they didn't want their beatitude to be a gift of grace, or they just wanted to find it in themselves. Effectively, they could not abide the fact that their perfection was a gift to be received. They wanted it to be a project of their own devising. But in making it such, they lost it entirely, because all of it hangs on this if. You can live with the king's daughter, provided you do not say the word onion, right? It seems, again, arbitrary and silly, but we can appreciate the inner dynamics of it, that we are made in relation, And the reception of divine life always entails the preservation, the continuance of, the growth in that relation. So what it is we rejected the terms of sanctification. That is to say, we rejected that it be a gift. So however you want to put that, just the fact that it was gratuitous, the fact that it was from another, the fact that we stand as passive recipients to God's initiation, whatever it was, that is what we found repugnant and so rejected. Okay? So then just a word about original sin. What is it? How do we describe it? Okay? Original sin is basically a habit of your whole person. So you've heard about habits. So a habit is something that we're conditioned to do, usually by practice, usually by a real deep rational engagement with some subject matter. And in the Christian tradition, it's common to talk about the virtues as habits. So the virtues are these particular habits that inform different parts of our lives. So our minds can be elevated by faith, such that we believe God because God speaks, because we know that he reveals and that he speaks truly. And it all hinges on that. It opens it up to a world that goes beyond our grasp otherwise. So too, charity can inform our will, that seat of choice, that most distinctive element in the human person, which, you know, chooses for or against. Charity can actually embolden our love such that we can love for God's sake. We can love our neighbor for God, unto God. We can love ourselves for God, unto God. We can love God with his own love, which is staggering. Whoa. Okay. So original justice, though, is a habit that informs the whole person. Okay? It's not so much here or here. It's more here. Okay? Whole person. It informs the whole person. So the analogy that St. Thomas draws is, he says, grace is like health. It signifies the good functioning of the whole spiritual person. He says original sin is like sickness. Original sin is like sickness because it denotes where health ought to have been and is no longer. So effectively, what it amounts to is the loss of those original gifts, the loss of original justice. So this means a loss of grace, that first dimension, so our minds are no longer subordinated to God. It means the loss of integral nature. So whereas formerly in past times, there was this order that obtained in our interior life, now there's just this hot mess of desire. And then a loss of those original privileges. So we're no longer immortal. We're banished from the garden. There's a cherubim with a flaming sword keeping us from entering again. And impassibility, right? We now suffer loss, corruption, sadness, weakness, sorrow, all the nine yards. Now, mind you, this sounds like a grim landscape. And it kind of is, right? I mean, it's March in Ireland. What else do you want, okay? I'm going to take a sip of my tea. Lest it cool. Okay, so it sounds grim, but it's not total depravity. It is not total depravity, which is to say that it's not a positive inclination to evil. It's not God made us good to desire good things, and then we become evil, desiring evil things. So a better way to think about it is this. Whereas formerly we had this original harmony, and we found it easy to choose aright and to choose well, now we find it exceedingly difficult. So all progress has to be purchased at a steep cost. So whereas formerly we would have found it easy to worship, holy hours would have been, you know, undistracted, unobstructed, unimpeded, and delightfully done. Now it's like you sit down and you think of a million things. You start making a series of notes to yourself in your iPhone, and then you think of responsibilities, and then it causes in you an instant wave of anxiety. And then you forget to silence your phone and somebody texts you, and for some reason you check it, and you're like, yikes. Shouldn't have done that, because now I'm deeply involved back in this situation that I had bracketed formerly. So it's like, we find it very difficult now, but formerly it was not so. It's because all of these things that we desire are now in conflict. They're no longer orderly, okay? So, when the harmony of original justice is lost, the various powers of the soul have their various tendencies, and they kind of go about it in their own ways. There's a kind of disorder that follows from original sin, but it's not directly. It's not like, whereas formerly we're like, let's do good things. Now we're like, let's do decidedly bad things. We don't actually desire evil. It's just something that comes as a result of what formerly kept us sane now being lost to us. So now, whereas formerly we had a fourfold harmony, now we have a fourfold wound. So first, the wound of ignorance. Whereas formerly we knew and saw clearly, reality was transparent to our gaze, now we lack it. In our will, we have malice, whereas formerly we found it sweet to love, sweet to affirm, sweet to encourage. Now, all of our relationships are tinged with competition. We see another's good as a threat to our own. We see their esteem as somehow bringing us into disfavor. So too in our passions, they're tinged by weakness. Whereas formerly we found it good and delightful and enjoyable to pursue heroic deeds, to be like Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, headed for the heights. Now we find it extremely laborious and just exceedingly difficult. And then fourth and finally, concupiscence, which is to say, we could look at good and delicious things and we could see them clearly and think, yeah, I would like to have a chocolate chip cookie and a half, but I'd also like to pray. Now we are just on flame with desire for things that are, you know, tasty and shiny and sexy and whatever. And they just direct our gaze and absorb us and make us forgetful of spiritual things. So I know that Father Thomas Joseph came and spoke here last month, so I thought I'd quote him on this topic. The first is ignorance, which affects our intellect. We are unable to grasp who God is personally and live in a kind of spiritual orphanhood regarding the knowledge of our Creator. The second is malice or egoism in the human will. This is a self-referentiality of the human heart that tends to desire its own good above that of others and even in preference to the goodness of God. This wound of sin causes in us a fundamental distrust of God and an effective antipathy to religious truths. Third is weakness that affects our emotional life of fortitude so that it is more difficult for us to struggle to obtain difficult goods. We are typically slothful or indifferent in the face of serious moral demands. Finally, there is concupiscence, an exaggerated desire for sensate pleasures of food, drink, and sex, wherein human beings seek rest or even personal transcendence primarily in the pleasures of the senses rather than in the goods of the spiritual life. All right? And you can think about that last one. People are more excited about tasting wines and getting really into coffee, whether it be fair trade or not, or like having a very refined sense of the best fast food in Ireland. I was encouraged today to go to some place called Mac something. What was I?
Super Mac.
Super Mac, yes. And then the person caught themselves and they're like, go tomorrow. it being Ash Wednesday. So we're absorbed in all of these sensate goods and we've forgotten the higher joys. We've forgotten the higher pleasures. People are just more motivated about being foodies than they are about being mystics. Okay. Now, just as original justice was intended to be conveyed to the offspring of our first parents, it was intended to be communicated upon all generations, so now original sin is transmitted to us from our first parents. So all of us have a kind of solidarity in the sin of Adam. For a lot of people, this registers as unfair. Why do I suffer the effects of a sin that I myself didn't commit? Well, remember, we are not born bad. God doesn't make us bad. We aren't due by right the order that obtained. That was a spiritual gift. And we're still open to the prospect of grace. We can still be elevated, right? But God could have made us without those original gifts, and it would have represented no injustice on his part. So to deprive us of them now, nor is it an injustice in this case. So, St. Thomas describes us as somehow complicit in the sin of Adam, not as personally being present and being like, yeah, go for it, eat it. Rather, we are present in Adam's person. He says we are all like one body. Just as we speak about the church as a mystical body, so we are all incorporated in one body of humanity. And he says Adam is like the will. And so everything is involved in that. When the will chooses, the hand moves, the feet fly, the mouth enjoys, you know, the mind takes delight. So we are all bound up in that original sin. We are all we have a kind of solidarity with Adam in that regard. So, but that's good news for a reason that we'll describe next. So third and final movement, redemption. Grace, we said, was originally intended to be communicated through marriage. It was originally intended to be communicated to Adam and Eve's offspring through sexual intercourse, right? So in the beginning, there isn't a sacramental order. Christ institutes the sacraments. In the beginning, there isn't religious life. It would have made no sense. To what end? Because everyone can enjoy the contemplation of God for which religious take themselves apart, because there wouldn't have been the kind of secondary concerns that there are now in light of sin. Right? So marriage was supposed to be transparent to the working of grace. St. John Paul II often speaks about the nuptial meaning of the body. The body was intended to reveal a communion of persons into which we entered as man and woman, as a reflection of God, which is, I mean, that's like a pretty grand promise. It almost sounds like theological poetry. It's like, hold up, chief, you're getting ahead of yourself. But the thing is, he's not. He thought and prayed about it for like 25 years and then spoke about it for 5 years and then continued to comment upon it for like another 20. So it was not said in haste, nor was it said hyperbolically. So we didn't have any strict need for the sacraments. We didn't even have a strict need for the incarnation. Whenever you encounter references to Christ taking flesh in the scriptures, it always says, firstly, in light of sin. Now we can argue as to whether or not he would have taken human flesh, but there's no strict necessity for it. We can imagine a human life in a certain regard without it. But the fact is that we did sin. The fact is that we are all part of the humanity, of all part of the solidarity in Adam. And what's wild about God's actions subsequent to that choice, though they are present to him eternally, is that he doesn't just clean the slate. He doesn't just turn back the clock. He doesn't just make undone what was done. Rather, what's beautiful about it, and in a way, God's wisdom, I mean, he is, you know, like you can't sound the depths of it. You can only appreciate it from a kind of mystical pose. But that God makes it somehow redound to something greater. Out of this incredible tragedy, out of this fault, which has resonated through human history unto the present, God does something great and glorious. It's often referred to now, downstream of St. Augustine, as a happy fault, O Felix Culpa. A beautiful illustration comes in, I don't know if you've ever read the book. Has anyone ever read the book, The Silmarillion? Okay, a couple. So perhaps you've come across The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien and then The Lord of the Rings. Those are the ones that he spent a ton of time on and actually published during his lifetime. But after he died, his son Christopher collected a lot of his papers and cobbled together The Silmarillion, which tells the story of the first and second ages of Middle-earth and like the kind of beginning of the third age, which is where The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings take place. It sounds nerdy, because it is. but at the beginning of The Silmarillion, he recounts a creation story. It's called the Valaquinta. And in that, creation is the fruit of song, the song of these elemental spirits. They're kind of like ministering angels. But into that song, by evil spirits, fallen spirits, malign spirits, there are introduced these discordant notes. So whereas originally there was a kind of harmony, now there is this real grating discord. And God could have done any number of things. He could have banished those evil spirits. He could have returned them to nothing. He could have sentenced them to a kind of imprisonment that would have kept them very, very far away from that beautiful and uninterrupted song. But what he does is better. He reorchestrates the good elemental spirits. He reorchestrates their voices to incorporate those discordant notes in a richer harmony. So in a certain sense, he improves upon his original work by bringing into the fabric of it, by bringing into the warp and woof this kind of thing that was originally outside, or seemed to be outside, but now we discover falls within the fold, falls within the plan of his providence. So, St. Augustine will say with insistence that God permits no evil to befall, except he can bring about from it some greater good. I will repeat that. God permits no evil to befall, except he can bring about from it some greater good. And I'll put it to you that this is not something that we can ordinarily appreciate at the time. Right? To speak somewhat autobiographically. These are the kind of things that I have discovered downstream. So I'll be perhaps at the house of a family member whom I haven't visited with in a long time. Since I've entered religious life, I just don't, you know. But occasionally, every once in a while, you'll be in a place where you haven't been for 10 years, and you'll smell something. You'll smell something that you haven't smelled since then. And it's almost as if you are transported bodily, not only back to that former time and place, but back to a former self. Because you can remember things with a kind of clarity that you haven't felt since. And often in those moments, I have the recognition that yes, life is still sad and lonely and anxious. But it somehow feels more possible. It somehow feels richer. It somehow feels more beautiful. And that gives me a kind of encouragement that formerly I may have lacked, or formerly I may have lost sight of. But being returned to that time, I can appreciate how God has been present, how God has been operative, how he has been saving me from all the many defects of my personality, from time and fate and moral ugliness, which pervades a lot of what I do. And he is bringing me to a new place which is yet more glorious, but precisely in and through the trial, the difficulty, the sorrow, the suffering, the pain, whatever it might be. And that's awesome. But that's only something that can subsequently be revealed. Because in the midst of it, all that pain does is just cause psychic trauma. And oftentimes it prevents us from thinking clearly. It prevents us from thinking straight. It prevents us from thinking well. And so we're not in a place really to interpret our experience until such time as Christ gives it to us, which he does. So, the grace of Christ excels in splendor that of our original state. And the thing about the solidarity in sin is that it now gives way to a solidarity in redemption. We read in Romans 5, "For if by the transgression of the one the many died, how much more did the grace of God and the gracious gift of the one man, Jesus Christ, overflow for the many?" Fixate on those words. How much more? How much more? So we can say in faith, "I do not know how. I cannot search the depths of your wisdom, Lord. But I know that you are somehow bringing us into the how much more of your redemption." What then is that? What then is that something greater? Okay? What then is that? We want to concretely explain this, and I have about 5 minutes left. Okay? So this is not a kind of Edenic nostalgia. We're not looking forward to a return to the garden. We're not looking forward to a return to our original state. But rather, what we want is conformity to Christ. We want friendship with Christ. We want to be lost in Christ. We want to love Christ with a reckless abandon that sets our hearts on fire and gives us wild eyes of witnesses, such that when we walk around UCD's campus, people look at us and say, "You're a madman or a madwoman, and I want something of what you are drinking. Permit me to drink of that fount, to imbibe of those saving waters." Now, mind you, I had people asking me that question, kind of tacitly, but it was because I was running around your campus in a 13th century garment. you do look wild, but for different reasons. So, what we want now is something richer, that conformity to Christ. What was originally transmitted, or what would have been originally transmitted by nature, namely grace, is now transmitted one by one, slowly, slowly, as the fruit of struggle. And it's historical, it's personal, it's contingent, and it's only and ever done in the context of friendship with Christ, which is awesome, and I would not take it on any other terms. So let's then revisit original justice as a way of summarizing. We said that original justice gave us grace, it gave us original or integral nature, which is to say an order, and then it gave us these associated privileges. The thing is, we get them all back, but we get them in spades. So grace. Grace, we know, is infused at baptism. It cleanses us of fault. It actually orients us to God by giving us a sacramental character, which makes us worshipers. We are made sons and daughters of the Most High God. Adopted, yes, but really and truly so. Paul's language in this regard is unambiguous. "I am the vine, you are the branches. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me." We live the very same life. Ours is created, his is uncreated, but it is the same. And you are Christ's, and Christ is God's. So we get grace now, but in the context of a kind of family life. Not one that's like kind of boring, wild, and woolly, you know, like let's all hold hands and talk about our feelings. Not that that's bad. But it's the kind of grace that like is thick. It's the kind of grace which accompanies you in every imaginable situation. So like at the beginning of his most beautiful homily given in John 14 through 17, what does Christ begin with? "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house, there are many dwelling places. Were it not so, would I go to prepare a place for you? But I do. I go to prepare a place for you." So Christ is introducing us into Trinitarian communion through the grace of adoption communicated in friendship. That's one. Two, integral nature. Integral nature, which would ordinarily have been communicated to our offspring, is now only slowly reconstituted in virtue, right? So we can grow in virtue. You think about this. You know, we kind of like give it lip service, but we can actually become better. We can actually become better. So in those moments, those passing moments, where you feel completely imprisoned by your vices, when you feel completely imprisoned by the limitation of your knowledge and love, when you feel completely imprisoned by lack of job prospects or fear of the future, it is possible to grow. It is possible to grow, and that God gives it and has promised to give it, and that the real protagonist of history is the beggar. It's Christ who begs for the heart of man, and man who begs for the heart of Christ. And Christ has promised to be faithful and to enrich us with every good and perfect gift come down from the Father of lights. So we can grow in intensity, we can grow in extent, and we can become more and more progressively stable and permanent in those dispositions so that, like, it's not always going to be a struggle. The saints do it kind of like moral virtuosos. They don't struggle for every discrete choice. It becomes easy, it becomes prompt, it becomes joyful. It becomes far better than we can ask for or imagine. And third and finally, associated privileges, these are deferred unto the resurrection. So think again that we await a complete transfiguration of the material order. We are not meant to languish under the burden of the many difficulties associated with this life. We are meant to look with unveiled faces on God in a joy that will actually overflow into our bodily lives, which will be returned to us in his final triumph at the general resurrection. So we get all of those glorified elements, right? What St. Thomas refers to as subtlety and agility and impassibility. You know, it's just like we get all of that. But now we will see how we have come to this point. Think about Christ's glorified body. How is he recognized? No longer by his face. He is recognized principally by his wounds. So we will bear in our glorified bodies the marks of our personal history, the marks of our very intensely personal relationship with Christ. And we will sing the praise of God in light of what we have endured, because it was with him, and as a result of which it was fruitful. So there is now a narrative dimension to the dispensation of grace. It is done in the context of friendship. We are incorporated personally. We are said, as St. Paul has it, to fill up what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ. Not because there is anything deficient to them, but because it remains for him to tell his story of salvation in you. And in a certain sense, that story is not complete until you tell it with your own voice, until you supply the notes in the heavenly choir that only you can. So, why Lent? Because Lent is a reenactment. It is a rehearsal of just this recovery. We adopt a penitential spirit to put on Christ and to pass with him through his passion, death, and resurrection. We believe, St. Thomas teaches, that all of the sufferings, all of the deeds of Christ are saving, but that the passion is especially so because it gives most eloquent expression to the love and obedience out of which he suffered and died for us. So in these 40 days, though they be dark, though they be wet, though they be stressful, we proceed together with him to Calvary, that by sharing in a death like his, we might partake of his sonship, of his virtue, and of his resurrection. So, as St. Francis said, let us begin, for up until now, we have done nothing. Thank you.
Yes. So, just about fasting and penitential practices and all that, they become a lot less severe over time, right? So, we go back to the Middle Ages, there was like very, very serious fasting, and then now it's a lot less severe, or a lot less intense. Do you think that people should be trying, do you think it would be good for the church to bring some of that intensity back? Maybe giving more of a rhythm or more of a structure to the kind of penitential practices. And then I suppose, when you're doing those things, what's the role of those penitential practices specifically play in reenacting that, that story that you're talking about?
Sure, that's a very good question. So I think that yes, we can bring difficult penitential practices back, but that we ought to do so prudently. And I think that a lot of the very difficult ones that we think of are things that you have to work up to. And some of them are, we associate them with heroic sanctity. So you can think about St. Catherine of Siena, who at a certain time in her life was sleeping about an hour a night and was subsisting on the Eucharist. So that wouldn't be the kind of penance that I would adopt tomorrow. Not because I don't believe it possible, though. So I think a lot of the crisis in penance has actually been a crisis of sanctity. that we have ceased to believe that God can actually transform the human person to such a bewildering extent that he is sufficient in such a radical way. But I think we need to believe. I think it is possible to believe that God can make saints. We know that the 20th century has more saints than all of the previous 19 centuries combined, at least those on the books, right? So God is working. God is moving. God is saving. And if so, then I can rely upon him to give me grace, not sufficient to kind of get in the back door, not sufficient to like kind of claw my way into purgatory, but he can give me grace sufficient to flourish, to be a saint, to live a transfigured life. And if that's so, then I should adopt those spiritual practices that conduce to those heights. I think that one should do it in conversation with a spiritual director. I think that one should be especially prudent about things that pertain to bodily health. So I think when you start restricting intake of food, that's the next level up. But there are certain things that you can introduce slowly, slowly, that are very much doable. Not to be adopted in a spirit of pride, but in a spirit of mortification. And we'll talk about that last and finally. But so one is giving up food between meals, right? Another is giving up hot beverages, which I imagine in Ireland would be one of the severest dependencies. So maybe I should class that with, you know, caloric intake. Another thing is cold showers, especially when you get, you know, my experience of many Irish dwellings has been that your windows hemorrhage heat. It's incredible. I'm like babied by American, you know, standards of insulation. I'm like, this place will stay warm for the next 36 hours. But like in Ireland, I found that like I watch the heat ebb out of every surface. I'm like, no. And then like the chill kind of gets in the marrow of your bones, and you can't account for the why that, like, you can't account for the fact that you don't want to move or like take this blanket off your lap, and like everything seems insuperably difficult because it all just reminds you of wet cold. Maybe I'm being slightly dramatic, but so maybe cold showers would be especially difficult in this context. But that's another really good one. Okay. Well, I could list more, but perhaps that's not entirely fruitful. Again, in conversation with those who are holier, wiser, older, who have done and suffered, okay? And then what should be the disposition with which we undertake mortification? I think the disposition should be this. What we talked about with respect to integral nature, our passions, our desires used to be orderly. Now, they are fractious. We want them to be reordered. But in order to do that, we need to deny ourselves. So if you have a 4-hour block of studying time, you probably break it up like 2 or 3 times. Right? You probably look at like YouTube videos, you probably check sports scores, you probably like listen to a little bit of music, whatever. A lot of those things just kind of play to our lower loves because we need to be stimulated for fear of diving in such a way that it could be boring or trying or difficult, right? We need constant release. We need constantly to reattend to something easy. But here's the thing. Material pleasures, at least initially, they have an instant payoff, but they depreciate in value. They very rarely hold up. Spiritual goods initially are forbidding. They seem nigh unto impossible. But as you invest in them, they get more and more delightful. And the delight, it's not even proportionate to. It's not on the same scale, right? It's not even on the same spectrum. C.S. Lewis said, to go from nature to grace, or to live, you know, a formerly pagan to then living a Christian life, is not so much, he says, like teaching a horse that is walking to trot or to canter or to gallop. He says it's more like teaching a horse to fly. So there's no strict proportion, right? So we need to actually subdue some of these lower loves in a kind of violent way to reaffirm what is best and beautiful, right? The kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and violent men take it by force. There's this beautiful passage, I don't know if you've come, you know, if you've read the Divine Comedy by Dante. If not, it's a long poem arranged in 100 cantos, which are like, you know, chapters. And the first third is about his trip in hell, the inferno. The next third is his trip in purgatorio. The final third is his trip through heaven, the paradiso. And in the second kind of, you know, piece, in the purgatorio, he comes up on the shore of purgatory, and he's there with Virgil, who's his guide through hell and most of purgatory, and they see this boat being borne on the waters towards them, and it has an angel for its sails, which is pretty cool. And then all of those souls on the boat who have just come from Rome, from like the Tiber River, as it were, they unload, and Dante recognizes his friend Casella, and he's like, dude, what's up? And then they kind of like get together about where they've been and why Dante's still alive and why he's dead. And it's a sweet reunion because Dante has been exiled from Florence and he's seeing one of his oldest and best friends, and it's just really tender. And then Casella starts actually playing some of Dante's poetry that he set to music, some of his poetry from Dante's first collection called La Vita Nuova. And then their party is just very violently broken up. The guardian of the shore of purgatory, one Cato of Utica, who actually killed himself when Caesar crossed the Rubicon, because he would rather die free than live in tyranny. He breaks up their party and he says, you sluggard souls. And effectively what he says is, climb the mountain. So in effect, what are you here for? You are here to ascend the Mount of Purgatory, to be cleansed of your sins, to go to the earthly paradise, and eventually to make your way to the Empyrean heaven, where you enjoy the unstinting vision of God. And that should order all of your pursuits. So do not tarry. And what mortifications do is they communicate that logic into our loves. We ought not tarry. It doesn't mean that we need to be puritanical or like Philistines about this. We shouldn't be boorish with respect to secondary goods. But we should order them in light of what is best, lest we lose sight of the goal and founder in our sins. That's the beginning of an answer.
What's the story with, like, and then you're supposed to try and break bad habits? You're trying to give up bad things, but sometimes you also give up good things for the sake of better things.
Mm-hmm.
But, like we have feast days and we have fast days, so some days we're not supposed to eat, we're supposed to eat less, and some days we're supposed to have, like, a party. Like, say something about, are we called to just end up, like, never eating anything but, like, bread and water, to, like, just be enjoying spiritual goods, or do we do that for a while until we have spiritual good, until we're, like, we're on good terms spiritually, and then can we, like, enjoy material things in the right way, you know, or that kind of thing, you know, because does this mean, like, we're just giving up more and more and more stuff for, like, our life, so that we can pray all the time, or...
Yes.
Yeah.
You see how tall and haggard I look?
Yeah.
This is the standard. You should all look hungry and hunted.
What's our relationship to good things, even though they're lower good things, like nice cake, you know?
Right.
That's not bad in itself.
It's not bad.
But we're not supposed to have it during Lent.
Just give it as an excuse to eat cake, please.
All right, here we go. I'm a Dominican, so I'm going to give you like a wildly impractical answer.
Okay.
T.S. Eliot, in the poem The Four Quartets, he repeats this kind of mantra-like statement in the second of four movements called East Coker. He says, "In my end is my beginning. In my end is my beginning." So what is last in execution is first in intention, which is to say, if you don't know where you're going, you can't even set out. If you haven't chosen whether or not you're going to Newry or to Limerick, you really won't be able to begin your trip, because at some point you're going to have to get off the N50, right? And if you don't know where you're going, you'll just drive it into the sea, right? So last in execution is first in intention. So where are we headed? What is our destination? We are destined for the loving vision of God, right? What will life be like in heaven? We will only do two things. Well, St. Augustine says we will only say two things, amen and alleluia. But there are only two things that we will do in heaven, and in truth of fact, they are one thing. We will worship, and we will love each other. We will worship, and we will love each other. All that there will be in heaven is the glory of God and the delight and love of saved souls, right? So what we do now is all with respect to that. So our life ought now to assume the shape of our life in heaven. Heaven will be a great and glorious party, right? But it entails a kind of purification, whether now or in purgatory. We have to pass through fire in order to live in that rarefied air. Truth be told, we are not strong enough to live heaven. Our voices have not been tuned, right? Our weak bodies, our feeble desires have not been strengthened to the point where they can live in that atmosphere. We would find it overwhelming. St. Thomas says that our minds, before the radiance of God's intelligibility, are like owls before the noonday sun. So we actually need to be fortified now. So always think about it in terms of the end and progressing towards the end. So we shouldn't be insensible to goods, because we are made for the enjoyment of goods. So if somebody asks you, as a Catholic, do you desire too little or too much? I think most people, because of the insistence upon like sex being bad, would say like too much. You know, I need to repress some of that. I need to get it down. Wrong. I mean, you didn't say this, so I'm not correcting you. The answer is we do not desire nearly enough. The whole point of this life is to grow our hearts so that they can be more capacious. So the standard of our enjoyment of heaven is growth and charity. We will be as full of God as we love. This is St. Therese's whole thing. We'll all be full of God in the end. Some of us will be buckets, and some of us will be thimbles. We will all be full, but we grow to the extent that we love. And so charity is the standard of our enjoyment of heaven, right? So, with respect to that, what do we do now? We want to grow in love, but that means growing in desire. That means growing with respect to those things placed before us. But we need to be able to distinguish between what's primary and what's secondary. So this is like the whole genius of religious life. Religious life is an affirmation of secondary goods, but a willing setting aside of those things for the sake of the one thing necessary. In a certain sense, a religious is like a bit greedy. He wants to begin living heaven now in a way that's already intense, right? So he looks on the goods of this earth, the things that we can possess, and we say, these are good, but I will set them aside lest I have to care for them with too much care or solicitude. He looks at the goods of the body. He looks at, you know, beautiful women, the prospect of being married, the prospect of having a family. And he says, these are good, fearsomely good. These are radiantly good. But I will set them aside so that I can exercise a different kind of custody. He looks at the good of kind of self-rule or autonomy. And he says, this is good. This is something to which I aspire. But I will set it aside such that not he can be lazy, not so that he can, like, whatever, live on the dole and kick his feet up at 12:55 every day and, you know, be done for the afternoon. Rather, it's so that he can live heaven presently, right? Because in heaven, there will be no material possessions. We will neither be married nor given in marriage, and we will all be ruled by the love of God. So he's setting those things aside for the sake of that affirmation. So we should feast with the best of them, and we should fast with the best of them, because ultimately we were made to love with the best of them, and both are expressions of love. We rejoice with those who rejoice, and we sorrow with those who sorrow. 0% practical application. Maybe time for one more.
Well, I can ask kind of two questions. You have two questions, they're kind of related. So heaven and hell. So first of all, you mentioned that God doesn't allow any good, any evil, without bringing some greater good from it. But how can a good be? So, but some people go to hell, and they never get to where they're supposed to go.
Yeah.
How can God bring a good out of that? How can God allow that? And secondly, sometimes descriptions of heaven can seem a bit kind of alien, like, or kind of alienating, that it's like, oh, well, we'll do nothing but, like, we'll be, like, united in an ocean of love, or we'll do nothing but contemplate God, that kind of thing. And it seems kind of, like, foreign to us. But then, like, you know, like, in, or I think Tolkien does this bit, but also in, like, Divine Comedy, you've got this thing where, like, in heaven, it's like all these different planets for different people. They're all, like, having a good party in, like, their bodies or whatever. But they're all also, at the same time, like, in, like, you know, their spirits are all viewing God, but their bodies are kind of, like, kind of having this, you know, having these parties or, like, writing poetry or whatever. So it's kind of like they're present in both kind of... That, what do you think of that as a description of heaven? Or, like, you know, we'll have our bodies in the resurrection, so, like, you know... Like we'll just be, like disembodied spirits, or we'll actually, like, doing... human things, you know. That's two questions.
I'll answer one of them at the audience's request. So with respect to that's an image of heaven that I find rich and encouraging. But the thing is that you can draw out or deduce many images of heaven, and none of them will ever speak adequately of the reality of it. So that's a cool thing about analogies, right? They limp, but they also reveal something true. So I think that you can use those to draw out the fact of, like, particular virtues kind of being made manifest in heaven, so that we will be associated in light of what we endured or where we triumphed, and that will be somehow on display in a way that gives glory to God, because that's the ultimate logic of the whole thing. Another rich image, which kind of answers more to your fear of it being, like, boring, I suppose, is perhaps you've had the, I don't know if you like hiking, but perhaps, you know, like, you hiked Kirkpatrick, maybe, with one of Father Cullen's friends. Okay, maybe you haven't hiked Kirkpatrick. The Wexford Mountains, I guess, are closer. Have you hiked them? No, all right, cool. So that feeling where you feel like you've kind of gone to the edge of what you're capable of, but you also feel wildly satisfied, that feeling where you feel as if something has been called out of your spirit which lay dormant until such time as you were tested, that feeling like you were pursuing an arduous good and it actually shaped you more into yourself. Because you got off the couch, you stopped whining, you stopped procrastinating, and you just lived your life. I think that that is a pale shadow of the kind of realization which heaven affords. Thomas Merton says, the saint becomes himself, and we do not know what we are capable of until such time as it is asked of us. Right? And I think that, those are the terms of sanctity. Right? To live fully alive, and therein to glorify God. So thank you for your attention. Cheers.